We have special news for you.
The forgotten men and women of our country will be forgotten no longer.
Are you going to send me or anybody that I know to a camp?
We have people that are stupid.
Hello, I'd like to speak with a Mr. Snotball. First name, Yura.
Yura Snotball?
What? How dare you? If I find out who this is, I'll staple a flag to your butt and mail you to Iran.
Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall.
It's the Ricochet Podcast. Sitting in for Rob Long this week, Mickey Cowes. Peter Robinson is here as well, and we're talking to Adam White on SCOTUS and other things. Let's have ourselves a podcast. Welcome, everybody. This is the Ricochet Podcast, number 340. And you're thinking, no, it isn't. It's number 339. These guys are using alternative facts, man. They're out of touch with reality. Democracy's in peril. It's over. No, I'm sorry. You're right. It is 339. I quickly and easily and happily correct when I make a mistake. It's not a mistake, however, for you to go to HelloFresh and buy something good to eat, because they are A, one of our sponsors, and B, the meal kit delivery service that makes cooking fun, easy, and convenient. For $35 off your first week of deliveries, visit HelloFresh.com and enter the coupon code, you ready? Ricochet35. When you subscribe. And we're brought to you by Harry's again. For the best shave at the best price, go to harrys.com right now and enter the coupon code Ricochet at the checkout to get a post-shave balm for free. That's harrys.com. harrys.com. Well, I don't know if they're going to sell combs, but if they do, they'll be the best darn combs you'll ever find. Coupon code Ricochet. And we're brought to you by Zip Recruiter. Find candidates in any city or industry nationwide. Post once and watch your qualified candidates roll into ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use interface. Go to ZipRecruiter.com and /free trial will be the URL you'll use. This is the point where you're thinking, is there Rob? Do we have Rob? Is there any longedness? And there isn't, because Rob would be here right now to tell you that we're also brought to you by Ricochet. That's right. It's rather tautological, but Ricochet is brought to you by Ricochet. And in order for that to happen, you have to join if you haven't yet. We welcome everybody who's listening to the show on the Slate Panoply Network. And if you're intrigued by what it is and you've gone to the site, you notice that it's not a cesspool of filth and horror and calumny and insults in the comments. It's interesting and peppy and civil. That's because we have a code of conduct. That's because members pay to comment, and it gives them, as Rob used to say, skin in the game. Rob's not here to make you think of his skin, but he will be at some point, unless, of course, Ricochet founders and evaporates before he gets back. Don't let that happen. So a Ricochet gift subscription, by the way, it's a great gift you can give for the smart and civil person in your life. And you might want to subscribe to The Daily Shot as well, Ricochet's free daily email newsletter. It's a great way to keep tabs on current events and see what's going on the center right side of the world, which is being redefined all the time. It seems to me what is right and what is center are moving targets these days as everything gets rearranged for the purposes of our new administration. Here to talk about it is, of course, Peter Robinson. Good morning, Peter. Hello. And our guest host, Mickey Cowes. Mickey, welcome back.
Howdy. Thank you.
Before the show began, we were sitting around talking in the usual collegiate manner of pundits everywhere, who, of course, you know, all agree on the maintenance of our importance and all these things. And let's pretend now that we hadn't talked about Bannon. And the question came up: you worked for him, Mickey. What's he like?
Well, I needed a credential for the convention, so I cut a deal with Breitbart where they would give me a credential, and I said I would write for them, and they weren't really interested in that, but I went ahead and did it anyway. It was a one-way deal, sort of like our deal with Australia. But Bannon was obviously running the place personally, and I was terrified of him. And I did everything he said.
Physical intimidation, or
no? He's a nice guy, and he seems that's what was so scary about him, because I knew underneath the nice guy interior somewhere was a hard Goldman Sachs banker. And I kept waiting for the banker to come out and, you know, and crush me. And he didn't do it. He was a perfectly nice guy. But the fear is there's nothing scarier than a Goldman Sachs guy turned hippie, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because you feel the hippie thing is just a facade and the real person will come out. Maybe it would never come out. But that's why I was terrified. And, you know, everybody did pretty much what he told them to do. But what he called it was perfectly reasonable. So,
Mickey, Peter here. You are a humane and liberal man. As best I can tell, there are two lines of argument against Steve Bannon. One is that he's personally a monster. But again, as best I can tell, that's just not sustainable. Nobody who really knows him or has had experience with him argues that, except, well, maybe I'm wrong about that. But it seems to me to be the weaker of the two. But the stronger is that he's built Breitbart, and Breitbart is so outrageous that we should have nothing. We, the nation, should have nothing to do with Steve Bannon because he built something that is monstrous. How do you handle either of those?
I think both charges are wrong. He does not seem in any way a monster to me. He seems like the person who he is. And I know the people at Breitbart don't think he's a monster, and nobody I know thinks he's a monster. He seems like a perfectly reasonable person. The charge against Breitbart seems completely gross and overstated. I mean, they have some very good people working for them. They report news that nobody else reports, and it's accurate. They have a couple of things I would criticize them for. One is I do not like the sort of promotion of the alt-right. They are not alt-right, but they sort of wanted to flirt with it and have it be the a place where you can go for if you wanted
it's a safe space for the alt-right.
Yeah, and something like that. And the second thing is they need an editor. I mean, their articles are sometimes very hard to get through, and they seem to have the idea that the longer you write, the better. So those are my two criticisms of it. Neither of them is worth, I think, boycotting it because they bring additional value to the table. There are things they report that nobody else does that are true and happening.
And the alt-right, how do you define the alt-right? How do you think of it?
I think of the sort of lowest common denominator of the alt-right is that they are white ethnic identity politicians, the same way La Raza is a Latino ethnic identity group. They are the white La Raza. And I don't like that, but that's not fascist or racist.
And
you move from there into the crazy of more more racism, more racist, and more crazy right wing. But some of the racism isn't crazy too. I mean, there are scientific race realists who point to the bell curve and say we shouldn't expect every race to perform identically in every job. So the idea of affirmative action, that people should get jobs in proportion to the population, is wrong, and I can't say that that's crazy. I don't think it is.
I think it's
technically racist, but it's not crazy.
Those are like people to me who will say that there's no Holocaust and back it up by pointing out that Zyklon B could not have dispersed in the pattern and the amount that they said. In other words, they'll use science to bolster an essentially regrettable, horrible, nasty, wrong, evil idea in the first place. I don't think most of the alt-right is guys who are poring over studies and tables of IQ. I think they're just people who very easily make the jump from white nationalism and white ethnic solidarity to tweeting out a pee-pee picture of somebody in the oven. If they don't do it themselves, they're perfectly happy with somebody else doing it. And they have intellectual cover for doing so, which brings us to Milo. Is Milo a Nazi? No, he's not. What does he talk about when he has his lectures? Well, based on the one that I went to, he debates the excesses of third wave intersectional feminism and tells people to get a spine. I remember going to that and hearing not a whit about the necessity of marching down to the square and burning books. But yet the anti-fas, the anti-fascist people came out and had a nice riot on behalf of closing down free speech. You guys are in California. From here in the middle of the country, it looks like madness. It looks like exactly what you would expect if you wanted to discredit and parody the left. Guys?
That's what it looks like to me, basically. I don't quite understand why, it was a very small group that could cause a lot of violence. And I don't quite understand why the police couldn't cabin it. I guess they made a conscious decision to stay out of it. But what do we have police for?
Yeah, I have to say, I found it. Here I am, what, 40 miles away from Berkeley. And, of course, I all the time I've lived here, Berkeley has always voted left, even by Northern California standards. You get used to the notion that that campus is a very left campus. On the other hand, also a very brilliant campus. And so these pictures, the television coverage of something burning in the middle of the street and people wearing black masks, black sort of uniforms with scarves around their faces so that their faces could hardly be seen, smashing glass with baseball bats, was really and truly shocking. If you go into the story a little bit, it gets complicated. There was a call, something like 100 members of the faculty signed a petition calling on officials to cancel Milo's talk, and the university officials refused to do so. They made a principled stand on the First Amendment, but then the violence broke out, and then it became a matter of public safety. Okay, so where were the cops? As best I can tell, they were containing it, but trying to avoid actual face-to-face confrontation. It could be that the cops behaved perfectly reasonably. I have to believe that they were taken by surprise. Nothing like that has happened at Berkeley in, well, decades, literally decades, I don't think. But yes, it's shocking, just plain shocking.
I must admit, I confess, I was part of a demonstration in the 60s where a right-wing speaker got shouted down. And I feel very ambivalent about it.
Were you smashing panes of glass? Was it violent like this?
No, it was a guy from the State Department talking about why we should be in Vietnam, which, of course, enraged everybody.
Right.
But it was preceded by a speaker from the local fascist party. There was a little local Cambridge fascist group, literally. They claimed they were phalangists. And he said, go ahead, shout us down. So if you're invited to shout them down from the podium, right, it's a little different.
Right, right.
But they were shouted down.
And so here we have another encapsulation of the special agony of, I know, Mickey, you don't consider yourself a conservative, but James and I are going through this, the special agony of these recent weeks for conservatives. Do I want to be put in the position of defending Milo? No, I really don't. He's a provocateur. He's not an intellect. He's not making. He's an act, as best I can tell.
I think that's a little unfair.
Is it unfair?
Every article I read by him, I learn something. I think he's a crazy lunatic,
okay,
but he's smart, and I learn something.
Still, I don't want to be put in the position of defending him. But against this crowd, of course I'll defend him. Of course,
I want to defend anybody who is unable to speak because people in black masks and black clothing holding up signs that say America was never great have showed up to prevent that speech from happening. What I love about watching these guys is they're waving flags, these little triangular flags. It looks very festive, except that the flag actually is just a way of concealing a metal bar. Because if you look at what they're waving, the sticks on which these flags are metal bars, which are very easy when you have to crack skulls because you're anti-fascist. It's wonderful. There's more, of course, going on this week, and I don't know if we have let me just throw it out. The riot is something that everybody can see. You can see people throwing things, beating people over the head, breaking banks, destroying Starbucks. That's on camera.
Right.
The news that we get, however, is often subject to interpretation, such as when we hear that the president had some very nasty phone calls with people. I'm to the point now where my guiding rule is do not overreact to anything. Do not underreact to everything. And that's the hard part.
Hard.
If I hear that this has happened, my first instinct these days is to say, I'm not so sure about that because somebody may have leaked something. A very willing and compliant press may have gone with it because it sounds good and it feeds the narrative that this guy is an out of control monster. On the other hand, it's not entirely out of the question that he did do something like this. So let me ask Mickey on the question of the Australia and the Mexico calls. What's your take?
Well, why shouldn't he be mad at Australia? I mean, Australia, after Trump was elected in the interregnum, cut a deal with Obama where we would take 1,200 or so of their refugees or wannabe refugees who Australia quite reasonably doesn't allow on its continent, and stashes in some Pacific island. And they've been sitting there festering and rioting for years, and they turned down a deal to go to Cambodia. So they want to go somewhere else. And why should we agree to take them? They rushed this deal into place to basically present a fait accompli to Trump. And Trump says, I hate this. And why shouldn't he yell at the prime minister of Australia for doing this deal? And do we want a leader who never yells at anybody? No. And did Eisenhower never yell at anybody? No. Of course he yelled at people. So the Australia call doesn't seem in any way out of the ordinary, except that, you know, Trump constantly boasts about his inauguration crowd numbers. But I see a sort of way of getting them to yes. It's like, do you want to cut the deal or do you want me to talk more about my inauguration crowd numbers? You know, it's.
But by the way, I would add to what Mickey said, I agree with completely. I would add that this represents, in my judgment, yet another breakdown in press coverage. It got leaked that the president had a very testy call with the prime minister of Australia. Nobody has denied it, neither the prime minister nor the president nor the White House. So it's fair to say it happened. But what Mickey points out, I found myself – you have to dig very hard in these stories. You have to read paragraphs 7, 8, 9 before you even begin to get some description of what this deal is. Mm-hmm. The Australian immigration policy is if they see a boatload of people going toward Australia, the Australian Coast Guard intercepts them. The Australian immigration policy is don't let them land. They don't get to touch foot in our country, not to set foot here. Australia is rich and Australia is empty. And we're supposed to take refugees who want to go to Australia. I mean, it's just crazy. But that should have been a paragraph. It should have been in a sidebar story, or it should have been in paragraph 2, not paragraph 10. Just amazing to me. Go ahead.
It's not completely crazy because people were dying in the sea trying to get to Australia. And the best way to stop it, Australia figured, was to say, don't take a boat to Australia. If you take a boat, even if you're a legitimate refugee, you're not going to get in.
Right.
And that stopped this flotilla of people and stopped people dying in the ocean. So
The Australian policy makes sense. The question is, why should a country which is rich and essentially empty, which has decided not to let refugees so much as set foot on their soil, dump their refugees on us? And it's because Obama let them.
I think they take refugees, just not refugees by boat.
Got it. Thank you. Okay, good.
Well, according to what I heard on Twitter, this was horrible because A, we have a special relationship with Australia and they're our great friends. And B, China is expanding its muscle and power and influence in the region. And therefore, anything we do to sever that relationship with Australia is very bad. So this was worrisome to a lot of people, which is nonsense because it won't damage the long-term strategic relations a whit. But some people were actually saying, this is what Trump wants. Trump wants war with everyone. Trump wants war with Iran. Trump wants war with Australia. And I'm thinking, you know, if we did have a war with Australia, I'm not sure exactly how that would go, because whenever we have in the last 40, 50 years or so a war with somebody, what happens is we get their refugees and they bring their cuisine and we have great new restaurants. That's why there's a million Vietnamese restaurants in Minneapolis. And I'm not sure what Australians would bring to the table aside from blooming onions and shrimps on the barbie. But if there is a great Australian recipe, you'll probably get it down the line somewhere from HelloFresh, because not only are they changing the way that people eat forever, but they're bringing a new set of flavors to your table that's going to make your family happy. Now, what is HelloFresh? Well, it's a company that believes that everyone deserves honest, natural, delicious, healthy food. Whether you're a busy professional couple or a large family that runs at a breakneck pace, or just somebody who wants to start cooking more, HelloFresh makes it easier, tastier, and healthier than ever to experience cooking new recipes and eating it together at home. We had this when the box came. My daughter loved to see all the cool little ingredients, and we made it together, father and son cooking experience. The chopping, the adding, the mincing, the rest of it. Well, I didn't mince very much. Wonderful time, a great memory. And I didn't spoil it by taking pictures of it and posting them on Instagram either. That's how precious it was. So each week, HelloFresh creates delicious new recipes with step-by-step instructions designed to take about 30 minutes from everyone from novices to seasoned home cooks who are short on time. It's about what it takes, and it's fun. They source the freshest ingredients, measured to the exact
quantities needed. So there's no food waste. You know how you something calls for onions and you buy an onion and you use a fourth of it, then you're looking at the rest of the onion saying, now what? You don't have that problem here. They employ a full-time registered dietitian on staff who reviews each recipe to ensure it's nutritionally balanced. And HelloFresh currently offers customers a classic box or a veggie box, which is, well, you know, and soon they'll be launching a family box. Now, customers can order 3, 4, 5 different meals per week designed for either 2 or 4 people, delivered to your doorstop in a special insulated box. It's really cool. For $35 off your first week of deliveries, visit HelloFresh.com and enter Ricochet35. You got that? $35 off, coupon code Ricochet35 when you subscribe. And our thanks to HelloFresh for sponsoring this, the Ricochet Podcast. Now, we have a guest. As much fun as it is to palaver amongst ourselves, we'd like to talk to Adam White. He's a research fellow at the Hoover Institution based in Washington, D.C. Writes on the courts and the administrative state for such publications as the Weekly Standard, the Wall Street Journal, Commentary, Harvard Journal of Law and Public Policy, and SCOTUS blog. He's a contributing editor of International Affairs, the New Atlantis and City Journal, and a contributor. Wow, what a great list of publications, man. And a contributor to the Yale Journal on Regulations blog, Notice and Comment. Law and regulations. It's been a week of news for those things. We welcome you, Adam White. Hello.
Well, thank you for having me.
Before we get to the SCOTUS, which I know Mickey and Peter are going to want to talk about, regulations. Are we going to be able to do this? If you do one, you have to get rid of two?
Well, I'd like it to work. I have to admit, at first, I was a little skeptical. It seems like the kind of system that can be easily gamed. I mean, how do you define what one regulation is? Is it a provision? Is it an entire set of regulations that was passed at one time? But what's interesting is this has been tried before in other countries. Canada has a system. Australia has a system. I'm starting to look into it. So I have an open mind about it. It might actually be a, to use the old line, worthwhile Canadian initiative worth looking into.
Before anybody else asks that question, I'm so happy to hear somebody say worthwhile Canadian initiative. You know where that all began?
I do.
I can't.
It's lost in the mists of history. It actually was a New Republic swipe at the New York Times, I believe, for having that as an actual headline under the Michael Kinsley days. Anyway, Peter
Kinsley said it was the most boring headline ever written.
When he was publisher of Forbes, Cap Weinberger wrote an article. What was it? New Grain Deal with Canada. That was the actual headline. It was unbelievable. People were falling out of their seats onto the floor of sheer boredom. Adam, Neil Gorsuch.
Well, Neil Gorsuch is the new nominee to fill the seat left vacant by the passing of Justice Antonin Scalia. He's one of the best regarded lawyers of his generation. He clerked for Justice White and Justice Kennedy, and actually the judge I once clerked for on the D.C. Circuit, Judge David B. Sentell, before going on to a very successful career as a litigator in Washington. He was then appointed, or he then went to the Justice Department and then was appointed to the 10th Circuit Court of Appeals based in his original home state of Denver, where he spent about a decade publishing a series of very well-put and well-thought-out opinions that put him on the national stage and then, thank goodness, on one of Trump's lists of judges.
Adam, one more question. I know Mickey wants to get in as well. But on Neil Gorsuch, this is a crass question. I was going to say it'll sound crass. It is crass. It's crass. It's me. It's crass. Why is it we hear about it, the judicial temperament? Why would a man as talented as Neil Gorsuch give up being a litigator in which the pay is multiple millions of dollars a year to go onto the federal bench, the strong likelihood being that he would spend the rest of his life there? What kind of person does that? Is it the case that people can make so much money in litigation that they can in 5 years put aside enough to retire on when they finally step down from the federal? What is the thinking there?
Well, no one's perfect, and we can't blame him for some of his less understandable or comprehensible lifestyle choices. But for whatever reason, he decided to give up a life of fortune to serve on the federal bench. But to be honest, I think that's consistent with Gorsuch's biography. As you may have seen, he's always been a thoughtful writer. He's written for a variety of publications. He actually founded a conservative publication at Columbia as an undergrad. He's written from time to time in such places as National Review Online and in law reviews. And he's always had this other side of his career, this intellectual side. He even published a book once on euthanasia and the moral questions surrounding euthanasia before getting his PhD from Oxford.
So he just genuinely prefers the life of the mind.
Well, he's had an opportunity to do both, and we should all be so right. lucky.
Okay. And then I'm sorry, I have to ask one more question just to indulge me if you would. Do you see in the choice of Gorsuch as opposed to Hardiman or any of the others who were on those two lists, one of 10 and a later list of 11, do you see the administration having made any concession at all to the confirmation process? Is Gorsuch in any way the nominee because he'd be easier than some of the others might have been to get confirmed?
That's hard to say. There was a number of very confirmable judges on those lists. Gorsuch strikes a very good balance, though, because on the one hand, I don't think there's any doubt that he is a thoughtful judicial conservative in the mold of Justice Scalia. You can see this from his writings, from his public speakings, including some really wonderful remarks he gave after the passing of Justice Scalia. At the same time, Gorsuch does appear to be one of the most, if not the most, confirmable judges on that list, because for all the comparisons you see between him and Justice Scalia in terms of his judicial approach, I think for purposes of confirmation, the closest analog for Gorsuch is Chief Justice Roberts. I see a lot of similarities between the two in terms of their temperament, the way they conduct themselves, the way they speak, the way they debate issues, the way they present themselves. In some ways, the way they look like very buttoned down Washington lawyers. And quite frankly, Gorsuch is, well, let me put it this way. While nobody could rival Roberts in terms of the professional esteem he garnered as a Supreme Court litigator, Gorsuch is also one of the most respected Washington lawyers of his generation. And I think it's going to be very, very difficult for Democrats to paint him as a radical or an ideologue, not only because his opinions just aren't that radical, but also because he will present himself very well in the confirmation process as a thoughtful, serious, moderate judge.
Can I ask a question on an incredibly potentially boring subject, administrative law? That's one issue where he differs from Scalia. Have I lost everybody? Are you there?
No, go.
The current administrative state doesn't work. Okay, in the New Deal, Congress basically punted to all these agencies the power to make what are in effect laws. It says, you know, take care of the public good, and then the FTC writes its rules. They have the effect of law, and there's no real democratic accountability there because no congressman has to put his name on the law. So the current system is, the agencies write their own rules, and then the judges come in and review them for whether they're arbitrary or capricious, which is a gratuitous extra step of review. As I understand it, Gorsuch wants to make that second step of review even more rigorous, which would be even worse. In other words, Congress punts to the agency, and then the courts second-guess the agency, starting afresh. Or am I wrong about Gorsuch? Does he really have a system where we want Congress to pass these things as laws, and then they're laws, and they're done?
Well, I like this. You could take the cows out of Harvard Law School, but you can never really take the Harvard Law School out of cows. I'd say the question – let me put it this way. It's true that Gorsuch is much more skeptical of agencies, and he has called for a reform of what's called Chevron deference, the judicial doctrine that gives by which judges give agencies great deference when the agencies are interpreting these open-ended, ambiguous statutes. But I think the difference between Gorsuch and Scalia at the end of Scalia's life is narrower than you think. It's true that Scalia was, for most of his career, one of the most, if not the most, vigorous proponents of judicial deference to agencies from the 1980s onward to service on the court, except in about the last 5 years of Scalia's time on the Supreme Court, he started to walk back some of these things. He explicitly denounced one particular version of judicial deference that he himself had created in the first place about 10 years earlier, a doctrine that's related to Chevron deference. And in his last couple of opinions in this area, he began to drop hints suggesting he might be rethinking Chevron. He started casting doubt on its historical pedigree and so on. And quite honestly, in the months leading up to his passing and the months following his passing, people, either friends of his or people who had been in conversations with him, started to reach out to me and suggest, often in strikingly similar words, that the doubts that Scalia himself was personally beginning to cast upon the doctrine of Chevron deference. In fact, when I wrote about Scalia for the Weekly Standard in the week after Scalia's passing, I just came out and said what these people had told me, that Scalia was actively rethinking Chevron deference. And so the point is, while Gorsuch is very far from where Scalia was 10 years ago, he's not that far from where Scalia was at the time of Scalia's untimely passing.
Adam, political questions. You're in Washington. Does Gorsuch get confirmed?
Oh, yes. I think Gorsuch gets confirmed. I think the only interesting question right now is whether the Democrats will filibuster and force the issue of pushing the so-called nuclear option button to end the filibuster. There's a number of – sorry, go ahead.
That was to have been my next question, but since you've asked it now, you answer it.
Well, again, I think Gorsuch you never say a lock, but I think Gorsuch is overwhelmingly likely to be confirmed for the same reasons that John Roberts sailed through confirmation. If the Democrats, the Senate doesn't look the same as it did in 2005, and if the Senate Democrats can muster the forces to filibuster the nomination, Republicans will have to decide whether to push the nuclear option button. That is, to have a majority vote, to strike down the filibuster rule on Supreme Court nominations, and in much the same way the Democrats eliminated the filibuster rule for lower court nominations a couple of years ago.
Right.
Now, the interesting thing about this is, well, first of all, it's not clear that enough Democrats will stick together on a filibuster. They tried to filibuster Alito in 2006, and they fell short. This time, a number of Democrats, including Senator Heidi Heitkamp of North Dakota, have already indicated that they're inclined to support an up or down vote on Gorsuch and not filibuster. The other question is, Democrats will need to think through the strategy of this. Do they really want to end the filibuster rule right now on a Gorsuch nomination? And that's an interesting question because the Gorsuch nomination doesn't change the composition of the Supreme Court. You'll have Gorsuch replacing Scalia. Gorsuch is such a moderate, his temperament and so on is so moderate that Democrats, let me put it this way, if Democrats filibuster someone like Gorsuch, they're going to make it a lot easier for moderate Republican senators like, say, McCain or Lindsey Graham to go along with the nuclear option. It would be one thing if Trump had nominated one of the more sort of fire-breathing conservative or libertarian judges on the list. On one of those, you could see moderate Republicans flinching and saying they don't want to blow up the filibuster over this. But if Democrats are filibustering somebody like Gorsuch, that might be enough to push McCain and the others over to go ahead with the nuclear option.
I think you're right, but the problem is Schumer is pressured by his base to get angry and take all steps and by all means necessary stop anything Trump does. The same anger that came out in Berkeley at the protests is coming out. You know, Schumer is feeling it, so he's going to have to pretend that he wants to win a filibuster vote, even if he'd rather lose it.
That's very true.
Right, because Garland should have had that seat, and it was stolen, and that's the new narrative. So, but I think the base will learn that they're about to be handed a sack of sand and a hammer on this one. Who's going to go next? The next one, of course, will change the balance of the court, people are saying. The next one that Trump nominates, if he gets through, it'll be the end of abortion, et cetera. So who might resign next?
Well, you never know, and as Justice Scalia taught us, you never really know. Sometimes these things catch us by surprise. The two justices in particular that people are looking at are one, Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, because of her age, and while she's in good health now, she hasn't always been. So much so that Democrats were sort of trying to push her out the door during the Obama administration to make room. So she's one that people will look at, and if she were to have to step down, then, of course, there'd be great pressure on the administration to replace her with a woman, maybe Diane Sykes, a federal judge based in Wisconsin, Or Joan Larson, another one of my favorites, actually. She's a Michigan Supreme Court justice. And just to get in one more plug, she also clerked for Judge David Sentell on the D.C. Circuit. But if the other one, the other justice folks are looking at is Justice Kennedy, who's now one of the oldest justices on the court. He's a Reagan appointee, but he's always been famously the swing justice. Judge Gorsuch actually clerked for Kennedy, so they're going to sit together for a while. But some have speculated that the appointment of Gorsuch was intended to signal to Justice Kennedy that if he were to also step down, he would have less to fear from the Trump administration appointing some sort of radical. And there have, in fact, been some rumors for a while now that Justice Kennedy is looking ahead to retirement in terms of how he's scheduled or not scheduled clerkship applications, all the usual Kremlinology that surrounds the Supreme Court seats. Who would replace him? It's hard to say. It obviously would depend on politics. One of the really great conservatives on that list, I've always thought, was William Pryor, a federal judge based in Alabama. He's a little bit more politically controversial because he's been more outspoken in some of his views. But there's a number of judges on those lists. And who knows, maybe we'll get another list now.
The right-to-lifers, I hear, were not that happy with Gorsuch. They would rather have had...
Well, if that's true, I think it says more about Pryor than about Gorsuch. Pryor has been one of the most eloquent critics of the Supreme Court's approach in abortion cases. He has also been a very thoughtful writer on what it means to be a Christian and a judge. And while he's always made clear that his Christianity doesn't inform his judicial, I'm sure a lot of right-to-lifers, you know, take heart in the fact that he's a practicing Christian. Gorsuch, though, I don't think there's real solid grounds to knock Gorsuch on this point. I'm not aware of anything he said to suggest that he's very far from Pryor on being skeptical of the abortion jurisprudence, perfectly willing to abide by it while he's on the lower court. But of course, in the Supreme Court, he'll have opportunities to decide whether to expand or contract the various doctrines. And like I said, Judge Gorsuch has written, you know, he wrote an entire book-length treatment of the subject of euthanasia. He obviously has thought very, very seriously about basic philosophical and political and practical questions surrounding the nature of human life and how it is or is not protected under law. I look forward to reading his opinions on these subjects.
And we look forward to reading what you write about them. Thank you for joining us on the podcast today, Adam. We'll talk to you later.
Thank you very much.
I do... The thing that struck me as being interesting about the Gorsuch nomination was this. Everyone is afraid of Trumpian authoritarianism. Everyone is afraid. Well, not everyone. Half. Well, 25%. Who knows? People just say, oh, he's going to upend things. He's going to shred the Constitution. Well, this is not the guy you choose if you're interested in shredding the Constitution. If you want to do that, you want somebody who believes that the Constitution is eminently flexible, that you can define and justify just about anything you want under the Commerce Clause, because the Constitution is a living, breathing document. But the Constitution is not a living document. It does not get up in the morning with bad breath. It does not have fingernails that grow, and it doesn't have stubble. You ever run your hands across the Constitution? It's as smooth as somebody's face after they've had a great Harry's shave, or at least so I hear. Vellum, in its original state, it's very smooth. Now, if you don't know what Harry's is about, then you've been paying no attention whatsoever. You know, of course, don't you? Right, the story is clear. You had a couple of guys who wanted to give you good razors at a decent price, bought a factory in Germany, and, well, frankly, for years, the story with the razor blades with the other guys is they increased the prices as they supposedly, and I'm making air quotes here, improve the razor that they've given to you, which is why you end up spending more and more and more and getting less and less and less. Well, Jeff and Andy aren't about that. They'll make an improvement, incremental or otherwise, in the product, and they won't raise the price. It's astonishing, okay? By taking less profit and selling directly to you over this disrupting internet thing we love so much, Harry's offers their blades at half the price. I had to pause because it stuns me. $2 a blade compared to the four or more you pay at the drugstore. So what do you get with Harry's when you order up this little special kit? Harry's razors include everything you need for a close, comfortable shave. Weighted ergonomic handle, 5 precision-engineered blades with a lubricating strip and a trimmer blade, rich, lathering shave gel, and a travel blade cover in case you're going around someplace. Harry's is so confident that you will love the quality of their blades, they want you to try the shave set for free. Yeah, you heard that right. Just cover the shipping when you sign up. Plus, as a special offer for the fans of this, the Ricochet Podcast, if you go to Harrys.com right now and enter the code Ricochet at checkout, you'll get a post-shave balm and emollient for your face, also free. Free. That's Harrys.com, code Ricochet. And thanks to Harrys for sponsoring this, the Ricochet Podcast. Mickey, we know you have to leave soon, so we want to get the most out of you we possibly can. You wrote a piece for the Ricochet the other day saying, guys, it's not 1934. There were people who thought it was 1934 during the campaign when there was violence and fists thrown and I'll pay your legal. But that's a little bit of hyperbole, isn't it? Now we've seen the guy in action. It's not 1934. You wanted a name for the absolute complete fear and manic panic that people were fearing about Trump.
Well, I noticed that, most of my friends are left wing or they're Democrats. And I noticed that they were serious, intelligent people who, with a knowledge of world history, who knew what fascism meant and, the subsequent history of politics in Europe and elsewhere, are seriously worried, or were at least until recently, that Trump was the sort of going to turn into an authoritarian, on the model of Orban of Hungary or the party that has taken over Poland, and he's going to start squelching dissent, or the manner of Vladimir Putin, squelching dissent. People who, disagree with him would find their businesses going bankrupt or government regulations stopping them from doing business. And we were basically going to turn into a mild semi-fascist state. And this seemed insane to me, but yet they were intelligent, smart people. And so I just tried to write a piece directed to them saying, no, sorry, this is not going to happen. You're crazy. America has a robust democratic tradition, and you can look at it now. I mean, this is the best time for the ACLU ever. Everybody's falling over themselves to sue right. Trump, and it's a grand old time for all. And this is just not what fascism looks like. And this is what the Nixon years looked like when liberals had a gleeful time cabining in executive authority. So I'm a little worried. I was going to write it. I've committed myself to writing a sequel where I say, how does this this paranoia about fascism go away? And I'm a little worried that it's already gone away. people are now mad at Trump, but they're not mad at him because they think he's a fascist. They're mad at him because they hate the immigration order, or he shouldn't yell at the prime minister of Australia, or quite rightly that he's provoking a confrontation with Iran. And why the hell is he doing that? I actually don't know. I thought Pat Buchanan's column on this was quite effective. But they're not worried that he's Hitler anymore. Or maybe they are. Adam Gopnik will still worry that he's Hitler. The New Yorker has a vested interest in worrying about Hitler, everybody else.
Peter, do you think that they've relaxed a little bit? I don't see it from what I can tell. It has driven people that I enjoy following on Twitter because they wrote about things non-political into these endless, endless laments and rants. There are authors about whom, historical authors who don't write about politics, who are now nothing but sneering/panic reactions right. to things that
I can't. What I've been keeping my eye on is the New York Times, because I've been reading it since I was a kid, so I have some feel for it over the years. And it doesn't – so here's what I see. The New York Times is in just a permanent state of hysteria. It's made the editorial decision that it's going to use the word lie and liar about Donald Trump and this administration when there are misstatements of fact. And yet at the same time, the New York Times, well, for example, it put up an editorial on Trump's executive order in which it referred to it in the headline as a ban on Muslim Muslim travel, which was, not to put too fine a point on it, a lie. So the New York – I'm trying to work out what – it must be – this is actually a question for Mickey because he has – he understands the left and liberals in a way that I – in a deeper – he's had experience of it. If I were in their position, how would I begin rebuilding the opposition? And I'm not quite sure what I would do, but I'm pretty sure that hysteria day in and day out is just going to wear everybody out. It's just not going to prove effective, that the New York Times in overreaching in its headlines, hysteria on its editorial pages, is undermining its remaining credibility, unless I'm reading the whole situation incorrectly. And the New York Times, a for-profit enterprise after all, has decided that the way to sell newspapers and clicks in this environment is to play to the hysterical left and just sit there. I just don't get it, but it doesn't make any sense to me from a commercial point of view or from a political point of view. This newspaper, these are intelligent people, and they're doing things that over time are going to prove crazy, damaging to their own enterprise. Mickey, correct me.
I think you hit on it. I think there is a commercial impulse, and I don't think it's irrational. I think look at what happened to Slate, my alma mater, where they still publish good stuff, but they've got a little hysterical too, and they're saying if you want to stop Trump, you have to sign up for Slate. Well. So they're making money off it, and that commercial aspect underpins the Times. Everybody makes money by pandering to their crowd these days, and people in the middle seem to sort of die. So I think the New York Times has said, okay, we're of the left. We want to be the king of the left.
Right. And, they just made a decision. Yep.
Which is sort of where they were heading anyway. Ever since Sulzberger Jr. took over, they've been sort of assuming that everybody who reads them is on the left. So I do think it's counterproductive politically. I think people will get sick of it. And the way they should get out of it is just by attacking Trump for his policies. Don't say he's a Nazi. Say, we want more immigrants, okay? You want more immigrants, that's fine.
Right, right. James, what about you? You're a newspaper man.
Right, I am, and it was it's been fun to be in a newsroom and see this stuff happening because, I mean, this – my paper has a nice Midwestern sensibility, wouldn't you say? It's not hysterical, but it is. It's always been seen as a liberal paper. And right after the election, I had friends at the paper who knew that I was on the right who would come up and say, you know, we did miss that. We didn't see it at all. We aren't a bubble. And we had a piece, I think it's today's paper, where they went out to what we call outstate, to Faribault, Minnesota, and they asked people about the ban, the immigration ban, and wrote a story about people who are okay with it. So it wasn't our paper's first instinct to say, find somebody who's going to be hurt by this. Our paper's instinct was to find somebody who's going to be impacted by this and go out there and talk to people who have seen changes in their community because of immigration and have this idea. Let's present the whole thing. There was a meeting at the other day when somebody was talking about, should we do a story about the stressful nature of contemporary American life? And, somebody said, because people are upset out there. And then the editor said, well, half of them are. It's heartening to me to work at a place that is not going to presume that this is 1934 and Kristallnacht is right around the corner.
God bless the Midwest. God bless the Midwest, where there's still such a thing as an honest liberal and a publication that views itself as a general interest publication for the whole citizenry. The whole citizenry. Good for you and good for the Strib.
Exactly. Now, and there are going to be people who will fault our coverage in the weeks to come. I get that. You're never going to make anybody happy. And I am I may be partisan about protecting them because I work there and I love the place and I want it to thrive and we're doing well. But I don't see around where I work that spasming panic that you find elsewhere in the press. But it's exhausting to have to keep it up. If you look at Twitter and you look at Facebook and the rest of these places, it's absolutely exhausting to maintain the level of outrage that these people believe is absolutely essential.
On the other hand, go ahead.
No, on the other hand, what, Mickey?
On the other hand, Trump would be exhausting even if the left didn't oppose him. I mean, I couldn't agree more.
Yes. I agree totally.
He,
yes.
He wakes up every morning and says, "Okay, I'm going to do something so big that you're going to forget the big thing I did yesterday." At some point, that has to stop. No, maybe not.
You're right, because during the whole immigration flap of, was it last weekend? It was last weekend. It seems like a long time ago. I was just thinking, well, so much for that problem with a phone call to the Mexican president. That was just blown right off the table. Let's rewind a little bit here. Let's talk about that immigration kerfluffle. a lot of people were saying the basic idea is sound. It is legal. It was just the rollout that was such a clusterfuck. Let's talk about incompetence, and then let's talk about legality. Mickey, what did you – as somebody who supports – go on.
I think it was legal what he did. He has – you know – you have broad powers to control immigration. He can keep out Protestants if he wants. He can keep out, you know, green-eyed people if he wants. And it was restricted to the main thing, which was a ban on all travel, was restricted to 7 countries that had been identified as by Obama and his administration as problems of concern. So he didn't make up this list, and it's not a ban on Muslims because most of the Muslim world is not included in those 7 countries, but those countries all happen to be majority Muslim. The problem I have with it is, and the rollout, you know, it was, yes, it could have been smoother, but, you know, they were worried about leaks. Look at what everything Trump does leaks by hostile bureaucrats. So if they put it out for notice and comment for 2 months before he did it, we would all know about it the second day. So they had a reason to think that they had to do it quickly with an element of surprise, and it would be nibbled to death by ducks. But why do this now is the question. I mean, the question is always, does doing this justify the blowback we're going to get from the Muslim world, where groups like ISIS and people who are maybe on the fence in the Muslim world are going to say, well, you know, this really does seem like a Muslim ban to us. America hates Muslims. It really is a clash of civilizations. I'm going to go to war with the non-Muslim world. And does that justify the added increment of security we get from this? And I'm not so sure it does. In other words, why do this now?
Peter, what was your take on the whole, I've already said kerfluffle, brouhaha?
Well, the executive order, the phone call to Mexico, the telephone call to the Prime Minister of Australia, I keep waiting. All of that has been run by Donald Trump and about half a dozen people in the West Wing, Steve Bannon, Kellyanne Conway, and a very small handful of others, because the cabinet hasn't showed up yet. I am hoping that a sheer element of simple competence and professionalism begins to enter the picture. Rex Tillerson's first day as Secretary of State was yesterday. Is that right? He was sworn in. Mm-hmm. First full day was yesterday. Jim Mattis has been Secretary of Defense for about a week, but the first thing he has done is leave the country to go on a tour to talk to our military allies. I believe he's in South Korea today and headed to Japan tomorrow. When he gets back to Washington, he'll have standing to go to the White House and say, here's what our allies are saying. Here's what we need to do. My happiest moments took place between the election and the inauguration. Trump named when Trump named one good cabinet official after another, I have to say, so the photograph of Trump on the phone to the Prime Minister of Australia, what struck me about that was that there are stacks of documents on the president's desk. And I immediately thought, wait a minute. In the Reagan days, this is the White House that I knew, there were never stacks of papers on the president's desk, because there was a staff secretary who understood, was in charge of the paper flow, which of course in a White House is extensive. You show the president only what he must see and what he personally needs to sign. There are all kinds of things, declarations of this, that, and the other, that where it's legally permissible to use an auto pen. You know, I just thought to myself, wow. Even on the absolutely basic point of getting paper through and to the president of the United States, they don't know what they're doing. They just don't know what they're doing. I'm waiting for simple competence to begin to emerge, and I'm hoping that it will do so with the cabinet secretaries as they get their own footing. And maybe all of this is just Robinson being wildly naive and optimistic yet again.
You don't get it, Peter. You don't get it. You don't understand. People see that stack of stuff, and they like to see that stack of stuff because it means that he's got information and he's working on it. But if you want competence and professionalism, which are wonderful aspects, then maybe you ought to go to ZipRecruiter, because if you happen to be hiring for those things in your workplace, competence, professionalism, well, where do you post that job to find the best candidates? If you can post it in one place, it's not enough to find the quality candidates. No, if you want to find the perfect hire, you need to post all of your jobs on all of the top sites, and now you can with ZipRecruiter.com. You can post your job to 100-plus job sites. Did I say 100? 100, including social media networks like Facebook and Twitter, and it's all with a single click. You can find candidates in any city or industry nationwide. Post once and watch your qualified candidates roll into ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use interface. There's no juggling the emails or calls to your office or Peter Robinson irritating stacks of stuff on your desk. No. Quickly screen candidates, rate them, and hire the right person fast. Now, you can find out today why ZipRecruiter has been used by over 1 million businesses. And right now, you, the Ricochet listener, can post your job on ZipRecruiter for free. Free by going to ZipRecruiter.com/free trial. That's ZipRecruiter.com/free trial. One more time to try it for what? For free? That's right. ZipRecruiter.com/free trial. And our thanks to ZipRecruiter for sponsoring this, the Ricochet Podcast. Back to the Oval Office, back to those cabinet posts. They're all going to get through, aren't they, guys?
Well, the one who's in trouble is DeVos. Is that how you pronounce it?
And why is that? That seems to me to be, well, is there somebody in the Republican side who's just so absolutely devoted to the public school? I hate to think they're getting money from the teachers' unions, but, you know, could that actually be possible in this world?
The teachers' unions helped Lisa Murkowski of Alaska get reelected. She lost her primary bid, as I recall, and she had to run as an independent. Or there's something unusual about her reelection bid, and the money of the teachers' unions helped pull her through. So that's that. Susan Collins, gentle lady of Maine, is one of the most, perhaps at this stage, the most liberal member of the Republican caucus. And those are the two who are against Betsy DeVos. So it's now 50-50 with Mike Pence to break the tie. If Betsy DeVos loses one more vote, she's gone.
And the bizarre thing is that a lot of the charter advocates have somehow been dragooned into turning against DeVos. You know, the big charter advocate in L.A., why am I blanking on his name? He's the richest man in L.A., wrote a letter saying, you know, DeVos will do damage to the charter movement because she's also for vouchers. So they're really turning up the heat in any way they possibly can. I also sense in the academic literature, the movement is slightly swinging against charters because the data is not quite as strong as the charter people would like it. So the teachers unions are ascendant again.
Yep, that seems to me to be. It also, I think that the day-to-day, minute-to-minute politics matters. Betsy DeVos did not look in control during her confirmation hearings. She seemed rattled. She didn't seem in complete mastery of her brief. They asked questions about things that she clearly didn't know much about, as opposed to, say, my guess was that the Democratic opposition would focus on Rex Tillerson. He has a kind of brooding James Bond villain look, was my guess. But Tillerson just held his own, subject after subject, question after question. And he just presented such a formidable presence. My guess is there's focus grouping going on and polling going on. And ordinary Americans looked at Betsy DeVos and said, gee, I'm not sure she even knows what she's doing. There's an opening. And into it they go, I think.
I agree. I don't understand why Puzder isn't in trouble. I mean, here's a guy who he started his career as apprentice to the lawyer for Jimmy Hoffa, who was involved in all sorts of shenanigans with the Teamsters pension fund. You remember all that litigation? Mm-hmm. That's not the most auspicious start for somebody who wants to be a government official. And then he becomes champion of open borders and bringing in more workers so that we can lower the wages of Hardee's employees, Hardee's being the corporation he runs. And then he starts talking about the wonders of robots because they always upsell and they never forget to upsell. And he's anathema to the labor left and he's running the labor department. So I don't understand why. And there's been rumors that he's been on the verge of dropping out anyway because the process of vetting is so onerous. So I don't understand why Democrats didn't move in for the kill against him.
Maybe because the teachers union matters more than the burger flippers of America.
That's entirely possible.
Last question, guys, before we go. Super Bowl. to me, it's the most gruesome part of the year. When I go to the grocery store and I see the cardboard displays with Super Bowl stuff, I think this is just the vacant point of the of existence. It's bleak outside. It's cold. There's nothing to look forward to. And I'm being pitched chips and salsa. And I'm not going to watch a minute of it. I'll watch the better I like a good football game, but I'll watch the good commercials on a YouTube compilation later. The thing that bugs me about this, Mickey, and let me tell me if you're right, and Peter as well, I get the feeling this year that there's just going to be a ton of splaining and lecturing to do in the Super Bowl, that there's going to be so many opportunities for conspicuous moral that it'll be hard not to read into these things, at least something that they do, that this is the beginning of the NFL's complete descent into it's gone.
You mean the commercials are going to be lecturing us on immigration? There is one that does that, apparently.
That's the Budweiser.
That's so.
Right. No, the commercials, the athletes, the color people. I have the feeling that there's this expectation and pressure, like on Tom Brady. You got to tell us where you stand. It's impermissible for you not to be explicit in your condemnation. So who are your picks?
You know, you may be right about all that. My pick is the Pats. Of course, it's the Pats. And I have to say that I'm not sure the Falcons will give them much of a game, but Bill Belichick is just an amazing coach. It is a pleasure to watch a man who knows what he's doing. Tom Brady is not a kid anymore, and he still can command that. He's not even that mobile anymore. He thinks so quickly. He has such a quick read. He has such a field presence. So the pleasure of watching people who are very, very good at what they do, and the particular pleasure of thinking back over the years, this decade now in which Belichick and the Patriots have been a dominant force, it is, to me, it's just an amazing human accomplishment what the Patriots have done. And there ought to be some pleasure, or at least I will, am likely to take some pleasure in just watching them because they're so good at what they do.
I think it's going to be a good football game. They have to make it a good football game just to stick it to Meryl Streep. My favorite tweet of the month was probably when there was some great football game. I guess it was the national championship game where Clemson won, and David French wrote, "Meryl Streep missed a good game." It was the team seemed the Falcons were very impressive, so I think I think it'll be good.
Maybe I'm giving them too little credit. Let's hope so. I'm hoping for a real game. But by the way, I don't know quite why. Because I was sick and I was reading everything around. I just mentioned this apropos of nothing except the Super Bowl. David Halberstam, who was killed in a car crash here in Northern California, 5 years ago? So this book has to be at least 7-8 years old. He wrote a wonderful book on Belichick called The Education of a Coach. It's just a wonderful sports book. That goes nowhere. It has no connection to anything else we've been talking about.
No, that's good. I didn't even know that. I'll get it.
Yeah, Halberstam on politics for me can be a little bit annoying sometimes. Halberstam on history, because there's so much politics in what he writes in his history again. But he was a very, very skilled sports writer. He wrote a wonderful book on rowing, and he wrote this terrific book on Bill Belichick, The Education of a Coach.
Well, I'll see you both here in Minneapolis when we host the Super Bowl in a little while. Got a brand new stadium, and so we're obliged, and it'll be lots of fun. Ice sculptures, polar bear jumps, skiing, and losing small, insignificant toes and fingers to the biting cold. Can't wait to see you all up here. And can't wait to see everybody else in the comments to tell us what they thought of this show. We appreciate you listening, and we appreciate, of course, HelloFresh, Harry's, and ZipRecruiter. Thanks to all for the fine support. By the way, you might want to head off to the Ricochet store to get some R-branded swag, so when you swan about town, people say, "Do you know Rob Long?" And you can say, "Who? I don't remember who you're talking about." If you enjoyed the show, take a minute, please, to leave a review on iTunes. It helps other people find the show and keeps us all going. And I'm kidding about Rob. He has a job, as we all know, and he'll be back as soon as possible. Mickey, thank you so much.
Peter, thank you.
Yeah, Mickey, a real pleasure.
Thank you. Same here.
Yeah, don't be a stranger. Come back, post more, and we'll have you on the podcast more. And it's always great to talk to you. And we'll see everybody in the comments at Ricochet 3.0. Oh.
join the conversation.